Talofalava, this is Pacific Waves from RNZ Pacific. I'm Susana Suisuki. Coming up, drought conditions in Micronesia go from severe to extreme. Also,
he had come across that he had basically surrendered to the wishes of the monarch. They have been, in my opinion, been bullied.
After a two-month standoff with the king, Tonga's prime minister resigns from his defence portfolio. And
it's wonderful to say all these things, but and the reality is you also have to take care of the people.
A study shows marine protected areas are worthwhile, but Palau's president thinks otherwise. This week, drought conditions in parts of the Micronesia region have been upgraded from severe to extreme, particularly on the island states of Yap. Also facing extreme drought is the atoll of Wache in the Marshall Islands. I spoke with our correspondent in Guam, Naina Rao, about the situation. I began by asking her for the latest update.
Yes, so extreme drought still persists across islands of Yap State in the Federated States of Micronesia and the northern part of the Republic of Marshall Islands, or RMI. This means those places remain very dry and they're experiencing major crop and pasture losses, as well as widespread water shortages or restrictions.
What other impacts has the drought had on the environment and local communities?
Yeah, so we're seeing the outer islands of Yap experience taro patches drying up and coconuts drying out. Many reports submitted to the National Weather Service or NWS Guam record yellowing crops. And water scarcity. Some of these islands' community water tanks are broken and water wells are low. As a result, they're running low on drinking water because of these water shortages. In fact, a few days ago, there was a wildfire in a nearby island south of Guam. It's called Cocos Island, and many people frequent it for hiking and outdoor recreation. The fire burned 5 acres worth of grass and trees. Authorities are still investigating the cause of the fire, but NWS Guam meteorologist Landon Eidlett told me that this was related to the very dry conditions for the region.
And what about the local communities? What are you hearing on the ground? Has someone spoken to you about their experiences?
Yeah, so I spoke with Larry Regatal. He was born and raised in Yap's outer island of Lamatrick. He lives in Guam now, but his family and his friends, they're all still back home in Lamatrick. They told him that relief supply vessels are bringing fresh water to these outer islands, and around 300 gallons of containers of water are sent out to these islands. And, you know, Susanna, these situations can become a life or death situation just because of how remote these outer islands are geographically. Droughts can get a little bit more critical just because the islands don't have a wide or easier access to some of the resources we depend on to survive, right? So water, rice, jerry cans, those are imported and shipped into these islands.
Well, what's the response been like from the government or emergency services so far?
Yeah, response efforts are ongoing with the state-level disaster coordinating offices out of Yap State, and then also out of the National Disaster Management Office, or NDMO, in Majuro. That's the capital of the Marshall Islands. As I mentioned, there are a number of relief vessels bringing supplies to the affected islands with the most significant drought conditions. International humanitarian organizations like Catholic Relief Services, U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, and the UN's International Organization for Migration are also assisting with ongoing coordination efforts. For example, USAID is providing reverse osmosis units, which are water purification systems that's capable of producing 360 gallons of clean water per day. And again, these agencies are also providing water, rice, jerry cans. There's a lot of people involved. And it seems like they have a pretty good handle on the conditions there and on the grounds. The U.S.'s National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration said that the U.S. Embassy is monitoring the situation, but formally, there's been no requests to the United States government to provide assistance, as conditions are still within the means of the FSM and the RMI government.
In your opinion, though, are they moving fast enough?
I think a fair assessment would be that they're doing the best they can. It will just depend on whether the drought worsens or gets better in the next few days, weeks, and months.
Has Micronesia dealt with severe drought like this before? When was it like this the last time?
Micronesia has actually seen a much worse drought than this year. NWS Guam's meteorologist, Landon Eidlich, told me that this drought situation is actually fairly mild compared to some of the more extreme years.
Like 2015, that was a strong El Nino year, and then we had a very dry period in early 1998. Many islands saw significant drought conditions, way worse than what we're seeing this year, that required a much larger response from the national government as well as from the United States.
He added that droughts are kind of a way of life in the Micronesia region, and it's something that states and government agencies plan, communicate, and coordinate as early as possible based off the climate pattern.
Has the Weather Service provided any predictions for when the drought would likely come to an end?
So, climate-wise, the Weather Service states that we're coming to the driest month in the region. Just to give you an example, March is climatologically the driest month for Guam, and it's similar for different islands in the region, but it varies a little bit depending on geographic location. Now, the Weather Service does predict more rains reaching the Mariana Islands in May and June of this year. But for the northern part of the Marshall Islands and Yap, it could be a couple of months longer.
In the meantime, how are people coping? And I forgot to ask this earlier, but how many people do you estimate are affected at the moment by the drought?
That is a great question that I don't have the exact answer to. What I can answer you is there are about 300 people in the outer island, in Yap's outer island of Lamatrick. So, in that particular island, 300 people are affected, but I can't give you the exact number. I do know, so Larry Regatol, Yappies, I talked to told me in terms of how people are coping in Lamatrick, residents are just like limiting and rationing the water they use as best as they can. So, they're using water only when necessary. And he even said that some people are bathing in the lagoon in the ocean just to avoid having to use fresh water. So people are preserving a lot. But he also emphasized that because he's been through several droughts growing up in the region, Larry told me that the reliance on community and having a community-first thinking has helped with resiliency during tough times like this.
That's very strong out in these islands. It's not about oneself. It's not about me. It's about the person next to me, and it's about, everybody else. So when you have a community structures that sees the well-being of everybody, then chances are we're going to work together to ensure survival in the long run.
Tonga's Prime Minister Hu'akawemeliku Siausi-Suvalemi has vacated his portfolio of Defence Minister. It concludes a two-month standoff between the Prime Minister and King Tupou VI. Whenua Whenua has more.
The major cabinet reshuffle was announced by Hu'akawemeliku at the St. George Building in Nuku'alofa. It sees his resignation as Defence Minister and the resignation of Cabinet Member Fekita Utoikamanu from her post as Foreign Affairs and Tourism Minister. Trade Minister Dr. Viliame Latu replaces Fekita Utoikamanu as Tourism Minister. But Hu'akawemeliku says the Defence and Foreign Affairs portfolios remain vacant.
We will actually make that decision soon, but we haven't had the chance to actually really look at that. When there's no acting, of course, responsibility is on the Prime Minister. Right now, there's no Foreign Minister, but I mean, someone can be acting on the portfolio.
It concludes a standoff between the King and Prime Minister since early February. when the PM publicly rebuked a letter by the Privy Council informing Cabinet that the King had lost confidence in the ministerial portfolios of the PM and his now former Foreign Minister, Fekita Otokamanu. The reasoning behind the King's decision to withdraw confidence remains open to speculation, as both the PM and Palace Office have declined to provide details to the media. RNZ Pacific's correspondent in Tonga, Galafi Moala, says the PM's decision is a major concession of power.
He had come across that he had basically surrendered to the wishes of the monarch. The whole ordeal, the way it came into across in Parliament and the way it was communicated today, my personal opinion is that the Prime Minister and the Minister of Foreign Affairs, they have been, in my opinion, been bullied.
The Prime Minister also revealed that the Lord Privy Seal, Viliami Malolo, was suing the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, but did not go into further detail as it was a matter before courts.
The general manager of a radio station on Bougainville says a significant number of businesses in Bowen, in the south of the main island, remain shut after a week of violence last week. Factions from Konoe constituency clashed in a town in the autonomous Papua New Guinea province, burning down many shops, including the local studio and transmitter of New Dawn FM. Its general manager, Aloysius Laugai, told Don Wiseman more about what happened.
Not really the radio station, but it was a problem for the community. And there was a killing in my area. They attacked our people living in Guintao. So I was one of the targets with other people from Kono. Kono constituency is the biggest constituency in Bougainville. And we still have infighting in there. What happened was it happened in Guintao, and police could not stop what was happening. They could not prevent the burning of properties in Guintao.
The radio station was just one of a whole series of places that were wrecked, destroyed.
Yes. Businesses from my area are still closed. They are waiting for, they did a petition to the government, and I haven't seen the petition. But I talked to the police, local police, because they have some youths that were involved. And the police officer in Buin, John Popi, told me that the stores won't be opened until the government comes back and replies to the petition. There was a big meeting in Buin.
Yeah.
Despite the meeting stopping the youths destroyed our properties. That's the only service, radio service in South Bougainville. And yeah. Once they destroyed it, that's nothing.
Your other transmitters can't reach through there.
No, until we rebuilt, now they have nothing. We established in 2017, so that's about 8 years. We've been providing the services, but there's no other service like that in South Bougainville.
You were down there at the time?
No, we have personnel on the ground who switch on. They make sure they control the situation. But I live in Buka.
Yes.
And we broadcast every day from, we are on satellite from Buka to Arawa and Buin.
So they can listen to you off the satellite?
Yeah. If they have satellite receiver, they can get us. But the transmitter used to, you know, relay the Buka station to part of Solomon Islands too, because we are on the border with Solomon Islands.
You talk about Kono constituency being the biggest in the region. What are people fighting over exactly?
It's a fighting between a group. They call it's a part of the crisis, and that didn't stop. We've got gunmen fighting each other, and it's just been going on. I tried my best to talk to UN, talk to the government to find a way to stop the conflict, but nothing has happened, resulting in its escalation that has resulted on burning of our equipment in Buin, South Bougainville.
We had been told that there were different factions from within the Mikimui.
Yeah, that's one and two.
So you think they'll be on the same side?
No, they are on different sides.
What are they fighting for?
To me, I don't think they have any good reason for fighting, but it's just payback killings that's not stopping. In 2011, we had a peace agreement signed between the Mekamui one and the fighters. And they started again. They stopped for a while in 2011, and they started again. And after the 2019 referendum vote, some people were attacked, and they moved, left their places, and they are just staying in case sentence in South Rwanda since 2019.
Is that related? Are these people who were opposed to the referendum?
Yeah. These people who were fighting, they were opposed to the referendum. That's why they chased all the people who voted in that area for during the referendum. So they left their homes in 2019, and they are still out there in care centers in Gwin.
And so how many people in care centers?
Could be about 100, between 100 and 200.
And who's providing for them?
Nobody's helping them. They planted food, and they are living on land only. But their survival is it's limited. They don't have any way to get money, but they're still there. Eight organizations like Red Cross have been giving them some food for some time, but now they are on their own.
So let's go back to the radio station. When do you think you'll get back on the air in Buin?
The cost of the damage is about 1.5 million. So what we are doing now is the situation is still tense. Once the situation is okay, we'll go assess the damage, clean up the place, and maybe do a fundraiser to rebuild for South Bougainville.
An extensive study on marine protected areas has found they're economically beneficial to both fishing and tourism. The report examined close to 50 protected areas in 25 countries around the globe in a range of habitats. The study comes as Balau looks to reduce the size of its marine sanctuary in a bid to improve commercial fisheries revenue. Caleb Fotheringham has more.
Lead author Professor Mark Costello says marine protected areas, or MPAs, are simple, cheap to manage and effective at protecting stock.
You constantly hear this refrain that, well, marine reserves push fishermen away, fisheries lose out, and there's even economic models which also assume that fisheries lose income or lose catch due to the marine reserves. And yet I couldn't find any examples of this.
He likens MPAs and fisheries to someone putting money in the bank and living off the interest.
Fishermen don't have this opportunity to take care of their best fish, and marine reserves are in a way providing that refuge for their stocks to help stabilise the population and the progeny of those fish and lobsters and other animals spill over to the fishery right beside it.
But in Palau, the country's president, Surungal Whips Jr., says the nation needs the money from commercial fishing.
We basically lost $3 million a year out of our national budget. These are fisheries licenses and economic activities and taxes that we collect off of this that were going into funding schools, hospitals. That had gone away. It had gone to zero.
President Whips says at least 30% of the nation's exclusive economic zone will remain protected, but all of its waters will be actively managed. He says the decision 5 years ago to ban commercial fishing from 80% of the nation's waters was an arbitrary decision with no logic. Mr. Whip says jet set conservation groups who don't know what life is like in Palau offered their opinion on what should be done. He says they have more interest in awards than well-managed oceans.
To come into Palau and say, we want you to maintain 80% because you need to be the leader, and we'll give you an award for that. Well, I'm sorry, that award never paid for a single textbook. It never paid for a teacher's salary. It never paid for a nurse. That's the reality we have to face on the ground. So it's wonderful to say all these things, but and the reality is you also have to take care of the people.
Independent policy expert Dr. Hugh Govan says Western scientists are fixated on MPAs.
The situation in developing countries is very different from developed countries. Often there's little money, there are many burning societal objectives, livelihoods are based on natural resources, the ocean, some a lot of its subsistence. There's not necessarily large amounts of tourism, and governments are struggling to provide services for their population, and natural resource management does not receive very much support.
Mr. Govan says marine protected areas are economically beneficial, but are not always the best or most cost-effective tool.
Fortunately, the Pacific has come up with its more appropriate approaches to management based on actually their traditional strengths. And those include the knowledge and traditional stewardship of the ocean.
Mr. Govan says the Nauru Agreement, which controls the world's largest tuna per seine fishery, is an example of a sustainable management approach that is not a marine protected area.
That's Pacific Waves for today. To listen back, head over to rnzi.com/programs. We're also on Spotify, Apple, and iHeartRadio. From myself and the RNZ Pacific team, 12 Fast 34.